How we going? Now we've got 55 minutes. We're going to keep on time because I know you're busy people, and we'll keep going through this and nail this. Let me just finish with this thought because we finished up on the four quadrants. Even in a smaller church, this holds true. We need to identify what style is required for what setting. One of the common mistakes that I've found is pastors get in the pulpit and go to choleric style. So they use the pulpit to correct, adjust, confront, deal with lacks in the church. Right? So they're in the pulpit, pow, 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 right? And they look angry. Okay. What I've had to train pastors to do, myself included, the moment I step up into the pulpit, I'm Mr. Sanguine. I'm loving, I'm happy, I'm promoting, I'm preaching the word. I deal with all the confrontation privately in meetings out of the church service. At any one meeting that I'm in, on a Sunday now, I could have 30 plus visitors sitting there. And then I start getting up there and pounding, and that's their first time in the church. They're going to be sitting there thinking, man, he's an angry guy. What did he have for breakfast? That's what people will think. And you see, so we've got to gear our meetings to that. And you cannot pastor your church from the pulpit. I call it the iceberg theory, you know. So when the iceberg theory, 10% is what you see. 90% is what you don't see. That's where you handle all that stuff. Always behind the scenes. Always in private meetings, team meetings. If you want to talk about a problem in your church, call a meeting of your leaders and address them. Go to choleric mode there if you have to. But even then, I'd measure it with a sanguine mode. You understand what I'm trying to say? Yeah. So what we've found is you get a guy in a bigger church, he's choleric style leader, doing a great job on the team. He goes out and plants a church. He stays in that style. And the people are sitting there. From day one, pound, pound, we're going to grow this thing. We're not going to, pound, you know. Now, in a bigger setting, he's cushioned by all the other complementary gifts and people around him, and it's not so overt. You get in front of 20 people, you're like monster. Yeah. We've had to help young pastors flag out, mate. Smell the coffee. Leave your clipboard at home. Leave your organisational chart at home. Just get into that meeting and love on your people, right? So really important. Pulpit, sanguine style. Promoting, teaching, inspiring, enthusiastic, loving, sense of humour. Okay? Feel good. Small group, phlegmatic. Okay? So my boardroom, for instance, we're going to do it again, but 2 years ago we moved into our brand new upgrade. My boardroom isn't a board table with leather chairs. It's a lounge. It's got a coffee table in the middle, beautiful lounge suites around, lamps in the corner. All right? Paintings on the wall, mood lighting. That's where I held my D group. Sitting around together, chatting, having coffee, low key, right? Because the D group or a small group, you must not go choleric. It's phlegmatic. It's sharing. It's empathy. It's pastoral. It's relating, right? Boardroom, choleric. One of the lessons I learned, I tried to run my board for years phlegmatic. I wanted them to be my friends. I want everyone to be in agreement before we moved on. Because unity is everyone agreeing, right? No. You can please some of the people some of the time. And maybe most of the people most of the time, but you can't please all the people all the time. And one day I had to have a discussion with my board to say, at the end of the day, I don't need 100% here to go ahead with something. But what I do want is honesty. I don't want board members just sitting there and when it doesn't work, go, I knew that. I've told my board that the day you say that, I expect a resignation with that statement. Because we've all got hindsight. Right? What I need is board meeting, board members that are in there, brave enough to disagree and creating that respect, right? But I try to run it like a phlegmatic. I want everyone on board, have cups of coffee, 3-hour board meetings, right? Now, 1-hour board meetings, 1.5 max. Agenda, minutes, right? Free and open discussion. All the board minutes are in the board members' fingers, hands, a week before the board meeting. If they have any questions or further clarification, that happens before the board meeting. So when we come to the board meeting, we've got all these guys that are all on board. See, they're all on. Anyway, rather than boards are for sitting on. Right? So you create an environment of robust discussion and honesty, but it's got to be led. And have a guess what I've found. My business board people love it. They get informed before the board meeting. They know what we're going to discuss. There's free and open discussion. Decisions are made and we go home because we've taken care of business. But we don't talk about the colour of the wall, who's going to buy the photocopier, right? We've separated business and spiritual. The board is not the eldership. The pastors of the church are the eldership. The board takes care of business, insurance, law, tax. That's the only thing they do. Unless the other is violating one of those policies or principles. The budgets are set there. But once the budget's set, the board doesn't get involved in how it's spent, when it's spent, why it's spent. We've already decided that, right? So we've moved our whole church into that paradigm and it's just released us. It's released the staff to get on with business. They don't have to worry about legality, taxation, budgets and all that. But they are involved in the budget process and the preparation of the budget. It's actually decided now before it goes to the board. When I was growing up, the board set the budget and determined the budget. Now, the operation or the executive pastor and the leaders of the denomination, I'm moving too quick, the departments, they negotiate the budget, right? It then comes into the board as a trial or a draft budget, and the board go over it. And what I say to the board members, I want you to double check it. I want calculators over that like a rash. I want you to check it, raise questions, and I want you to align the budget to the purpose and values and goals of the church. Is this budget going to help us further build the church and reach our goals and values, right? Rather than, I don't think we ought to be buying an overhead projector. What does a board member know, right? The pastor knows. Not the board member, right? Then once that's done and they have the right to correct or whatever, it then goes back to operations, it's finalised, then it comes back to the board and it's ratified. Once that's done, it's not up to the board now to action the budget. Their job is finished in that regard. Then that budget comes back with a quarterly report, you know, the actual versus budget variance, etc., and that comes across their eyes every quarter. And they are to raise questions regarding the budget, the vision, the purpose, and the expenditure. So that's like your balance and your check, right? And so in that setting, can you see where I had to go to? And that was a major change for me because, A, my culture wasn't that. I was brought up in an eldership that pontificated for years and eventually decided maybe to do one or two things. You know, it was frustrating, absolutely frustrating. But I find you need to be in a culture where if you're in the board meeting, you need to learn those traits of the choleric style. There's a purpose for this meeting, there's an agenda, there's minutes, there's record taking, there's open discussion, then decisions are made. Right? And then you find the board works well and the board members love it. And I've found once we got into that zone, our board meetings are awesome, you know. And sometimes we have tough discussions, you know. Sometimes there are questions that are going to be asked. That's totally cool. But it's in a setting that's happening, right? Then when I go and wait on God, I've got to go into a melancholy zone. When I go to the prayer meeting. Okay, pray now, you've got 5 minutes. Over. Right, what are we going to do now? You know, no, you go into the prayer meeting, you've got to go to that reflective melancholy mode and just wait on God and hang with God and the presence of God. So, see, we need all, right?
Yeah.
And so that's really important in understanding what style you need to adopt, right? Okay, here's another one. I used to go to bank managers. I hope there's no bank managers here today. But I used to go to bank managers in a phlegmatic, melancholy style. Look, I sort of need some money. Would you like to give it to me? No. Oh, okay. Now I go to them sanguine, choleric style. I go with a proposal, a sales job, and then I'm a bit choleric with them. So I just said to my bank manager just recently, I got him in, had a big morning tea for him, put a big proposal together and did the big sales pitch. Showed him what we're doing and had DVDs and gave him brochures and, you know, the whole thing. He's going, wow, that was awesome, Gordon, congratulations. I said, yeah, well, here's what's going to happen. In 3 months, I'm coming back to you and I need $3 million. And, you know, it'll happen if you're unable to help me. I'm going to go elsewhere. I would never say that ever. But he's a good bank manager. He goes, mate, I don't see a problem. I said, great, I just thought I'd raise it. So that was the sanguine. So I'm going to raise it, you know, because I've got to have that money and I'm going to get it because we've made a decision at board level and leader, this is what we're going to do. So now it's my job to do it. But if I go and, oh, and maybe, and go, oh, well, we can't do it, right? I've got to be able to go in there and really sell our case. And, you know, as pastors, we need to learn how to do that, to really learn. And if you can't do it yourself, get some people to help you. You know, you might have a business person or someone you know to put your story on PowerPoint, you know, what you're wanting to do, and learn how to sell and promote your vision. And I expect this of our heads of department. You know, now young people tend to be a bit better about it, I reckon. But all of our departments need to really promote. And that's going to that sanguine zone again, to promote. Don't leave it up to choice. Don't leave it up to, well, if it happens, it's God. If it doesn't, que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be. No. You go into the zone of I'm gonna believe God and I'm going to work with God. And you know God can get on it and it excites people. And business people go, I'll give to that. And then away you go. Rather than you don't quite know what you're doing and you're all apologetic and, you know, and then it's all awkward, you know, and. You know, I used to take up the offerings like this. We're now going to take up the hand, here's for the hand, and let's do the notices. And that was the cue for, you know, pass the bags along, you know. Now, I take up an offering, and when I get with the church, take up an offering, they cheer. So we've got to create a culture of giving, right? So I say, church, we're going to take up the tithes and offerings. They go, hey, let's do it. So I want you to hold your checks right now. Just hold it. Let's turn in the Word of God. And I'll give like a 2-minute, exciting promotion of the blessing of giving. Right? And then we go for our offering. And then I say, and we're going to do it. We're going to worship God. And we really take up the offerings. That's been a mindset change for me. So that's not a choleric zone. That's a total sanguine, happy, this is the best thing. People get excited about giving. And we teach into the giving in our church. So that's all related to what personality do I go to. Don't take up an offering choleric. You people aren't giving, and if you're going to give, there's the door. You know, you don't go there. That's real bad, okay? But you don't want to be phlegmatic. Hey, if you don't want to give, don't give. You know, it's cool. I'm cool. You're cool. But inside you're going, they've got to give. You know, but you're just sitting there, and it's not a real offering, you know? So you've got to go to that sanguine mode. Learn how to do it. It doesn't mean you've got to be a sanguine, but just learn how to sell your case. And you know, if you have someone else in your church that's better at it, let him take up an offering, or her, every now and again. You know, don't you do all the taking up of the offerings. Get someone else to do it too, you see. So we're in this. We're going to do this. And then you begin to go to a style that's going to meet the need or help you reach the goal that you need to reach. Okay, so that's just what I want to conclude with the styles. Okay, really important here. Okay, so you understand. And sometimes for us as pastors, we need to literally stand at the door before we go in. Okay, so I've just been pastoring and counseling phlegmatic, and I'm going now into a board meeting. I need to almost go to the door and go, organized, in control, confident, this is going to be a great meeting. Hi guys, how you going? Let's sit down and get into our meeting. Away we go. You know? And sometimes you've literally got to do that if it's not naturally you. But just learn how to get over yourself and get into it and do it. You know, well, it's not me, and you know, what will they think? And you go all there, and then it's all mushy. You know, I want to encourage you as pastors and leaders, be confident, be strong, and the Lord will be with you. And it's just a matter of getting the right style to suit that. How does that sound? Let's talk about church, small church mentality. We've got about 40 minutes. By small church mentality, I don't mean small church people or small churches. I'm talking about a mentality, okay? Recently, a businessman came to me. He rang up on the phone and he said, Gordon, I need to see you. I've got a few things happening. I need to talk. I said, well, are you talking to your pastor? And he says, well, yeah, but, you know, well, whatever, but I need to talk to you. So, okay. And I wouldn't usually do this, but I thought, well, he's been around for a while and I'll give him some time. And I could fit it on. I said, look, I've got half an hour coming for a coffee. So he comes in and he sits down and he begins to talk about it. I went, wait a minute. I need to ask you a question. He goes, yeah. I said, who's your pastor? He said, you are. I said, no, I'm not your pastor. He was shocked. He said, what do you mean you're not my pastor? I said, I'm your leader, but I'm not your pastor. Who is your pastor? What about this guy? Oh, well, you know, and I've known him for ages and, you know. I really want to relate to you. I said, well, it's not going to happen. Because I pastor the pastors. And I can't give you the time you need. You need someone that when you need them, they can come into your business, into your world and help you. And I said, I'm going to disappoint you if I promise that to you. And you know, I left that meeting and I thought, here's one of my key business guys in a church of 2,500. He's still thinking small mentality. He still thinks he's got access to me. And I have to sharpen this up somehow. Now, I just blame myself, you know, I don't say it's his fault. I'm just saying, well, gee, I've got some work to do yet. So what I'm trying to say is, you know, this is not about church size. This is about a mentality that needs, I reckon it needs nailing. Because if we don't nail it, we're just going to excuse ceilings and lack of growth, and we're just going to be coming through life going, well, you know, it's all cool. But is it? You know, remember the good old days. When we were small, we had quality. This church has become professional. What do you mean I need an appointment to see the pastor? I don't know everyone. We need to get everyone together. Every now and again that comes up. Why can't we just get all together? Listen, I'm not going to a barbecue with 2,500 people. Forget it. You know? I don't mind being in a church fair or a big event, but if you want to have a barbecue, we're all going to get together and just fellowship with 2,500. It isn't going to happen. Do you know how many dummies you need? How many barbecues you need? It's like mega day. You know, and so, but their idea is let's all relate together. You can't all relate together once the church goes over probably about 250. It's gone. Now you have times when you do that, but real fellowship's going to happen in the small group, isn't it? And in the departments rather than in the whole. The church is too big. Well, of course, the question is too big for who? And really, I think sometimes that is an omission by people that they still want to be small and keep it neat and tidy, and it's sort of got this big thing that I can't cope. And you'll, as pastors, you'll have to confront that and face that at every level of growth. So it's not just about, oh, there's 1,000 people in the church, so it's big. You will get people, once you begin to, say, take on board some of these things and say, hey, we're really going well at 75, but I believe we can have 200, you'll get people coming to you offering you drugs and saying, calm down, you need the sedative, pastor. No one's ever grown a church of 200 in this town. It's not going to happen, man. This is too hard. This is too difficult. And then all of a sudden, you're on the back foot. So it's not about the numbers. It's about a mindset of church, right? About what we want. So what is that mindset? I've given a lot of thought to this. We've seen these numbers. You know, we saw them before. Will we ever see an increase in the average size churches? Well, we already are. Here's the latest Australian statistics. 75 average world size church. In 2001, 131 average size Australian Pentecostal church. Last year in a meeting I had with heads of the AOG in Australia, they're saying their average size is about 168. And that's probably gone up since then because they are growing and planting churches. And in the C3I churches in Australia, our current membership church size is 401. So I believe this whole idea that we have to remain small is just not really viable. So what is the mindset? The mindset is threefold. Everyone is involved, everyone is informed, and everyone is an influence. And human beings want to hold on to these things. Everyone is involved. Why do the youth have to do all their things by themselves? Why can't we have the youth all together? Because the youth don't want to be with you. They do know. At the end of the day, the youth, a 16-year-old doesn't want to hang with a 55-year-old. And if he does, there's something wrong. It's just a wrong picture. You know what I'm trying to say? So we just need to get there. Now, that doesn't mean to say that youth aren't involved in our church. Like in our church, I'm 55 and the average age of my church is 20. I'm surrounded in young people, but I'm creating an environment in which they are feeling part of it and it's growing, right? But I don't pastor 12-year-olds. You know what I'm trying to say? I lead them, but I don't pastor them. There's a whole team of people doing that, right? But we keep a small church mentality when we want everyone to be involved. Now, take the young marrieds, for instance, the young marriage department. I think we've got about four sub-departments. We've got young marrieds without children. We've got young marrieds with babies. We've got young marrieds with preschoolers and early school. And we've got young marrieds with school-age children. Then there's another group that we're discovering in our church is older people in their late 30s, early 40s who marry late or decide to have children late, have little babies, but they don't fit into the young marriage with little kids. We just found this the other week, you know. So we had this couple going to leave the church and we said, why are you leaving? And they said, we just can't make any friends. We said, why? There's heaps of people your age. Well, I don't meet them. Why don't you meet them? Well, we go to the young marriage group, with the young families group, and they're all, well, excuse the expression, they're kids. I'm a 40-year-old, 42-year-old, you know, and I said, well, why are you going there for? Because we've got babies. No. You can afford a babysitter. Get a babysitter and go to a 40-year-old group where you can make friends with your peers. Oh, we're allowed to do that. You know, people, you know, it doesn't, in the system. So what am I saying? What I'm saying is young married couples without babies don't want to go out for dinner and talk about nappies and, you know, bottom wipes and different kinds of baby food. That's what we've discovered. They want to talk about their career and their job and the trip over to Europe and all that. It'll happen to them sooner or later, right? You know. But right then... And so if you keep pushing that to get everyone involved, you'll get this feeling in the group, kind of, well, I don't want to be involved in that. So we have to set up in the church opportunities for each age and stage group to relate to one another. And then people transition through them. You see them transitioning through the church, you know. And they're in kids' church. We've got, you know, and then they go through high school ministry. Then they get into the university ministry, young marrieds. And they might be leading in youth because they love it, but now they've got kids and they're in the young marriage kids group and so forth. But you see, if we restrict that and say, no, we only have youth, and then you've got a 25-year-old having to hang with a 15, it's not going to work, you know. Now, in a conference or a meeting, that happens, but in their pastoring and in their interaction, it's not right. Everyone's informed, small church mindset is that everyone has to be informed. People get a real surprise when they find out how ill-informed I am. I turned up the other week and I saw this photocopier in the office and I had two problems. A, I couldn't work it without even looking at it. You needed a degree to work it. And secondly, I knew it was worth 20 grand. If it was a dollar. Number one, I didn't know it was bought. Number two, I didn't really know how much it was worth. So I thought, I'm a smart guy. I'm a techo. I can work it. I can sort this out. So I started. I couldn't get the thing working, you know. And then I was getting mad. And I felt like, and then I heard this voice from behind the screen. Just type in 8810, Pastor. I knew that. 8810. And it all comes on, you know, and it's all working. And, you know. So what I'm trying to say is, a small church mentality says nothing's going to happen in this church unless I am informed. How do you break down small church mentality? You discuss it and you say, we're not going to be informed. We don't need to inform you. But the people that need to be informed will be informed. We had an elder leave one of our churches recently. He was really cut up. He arrived on a Sunday and there was a baby dedication and the pastor didn't tell him. How come this is happening and I wasn't informed? Well, you don't need to be informed. You're an elder. I was here from the beginning and I've put money in it and away he went, you know. And the pastor said to me, what do I do? I said, ask him to leave. Just tell him to go. Don't worry about it. He can get in the church where they'll inform him. But you're trying to grow a church where not everyone's going to be informed. He got really upset. And he had no right to get upset. It was a pastoral issue, not a board issue. But see, the small church mentality wants everyone on board, everyone informed. Oh, man. I signed out of that a long time ago. As a matter of fact, I don't know half the things that are happening in the church, but I do know this. I know that good people do know. See, and that's leadership. Rather than I have to know. Right? Okay? Everyone is an influence. I think this really bites to the core of small church mentality. I think as human beings, we all want a slice of the cake. And we want to feel that we have the pastor's ear. And I think one of the reasons why people don't like crossing through the 200 is they sense they're not going to be able to just come in and have a cup of coffee with Gordo. He's not going to be available at any time to me. But you know, that's the reality. And we lose influence. And I've found the bigger the church has got, I've lost influence. There are key things that I have a voice into and I'm influencing. There's a lot of things that happen in our church that I don't even know it's happening and I have no influence in it in the sense that I'm there to make it happen. So that's why we've moved the church into a vision, value, policy-driven church rather than what Gordon wants. If you run a church around what Gordon wants and the primary group wants, you'll keep a small mentality happening in the church where everyone wants to influence every decision. You know, and that's education, that's creating a culture. So when do our churches grow and break through that 200 zone? Have I talked about the personal contact level? We've got to adjust that. In other words, once a group gets around 180 to 220, the senior leader of that group, whether it's a church, a youth group, a women's ministry, whatever, loses his or her ability to have personal contact with everyone in that group. That's why when you go back to the previous screen, you're not involving everyone, you're not informing everyone because it's grown past that. And the number seems to be around 200. Now, in everything that I've said today, I hope you've picked up that that's not arbitrary. You know what I'm trying to say? In other words, when you've got 201, you've broken through. Churches could go to 300. And are still operating in the second quadrant. You understand what I'm saying? Right. And we've discussed that. It was a really good question that was raised before. The church becomes a vision-driven church rather than a personality-driven church. So the facts are, I was away last weekend. I think church still happened. Right? I think a true test of whether our church is a personality-driven church or a vision-driven church is if you go away for a month and the offerings start dipping, attendance dries up, money starts drying up, you've got to get back and pump the thing and lift it. Now, when the church is in its formative years, it is a personality-driven church because you're the pastor, you're the leader, you and your wife and the primary group make it happen, right? But as the church grows, we've got to move it from that to being a vision-driven church. What's our purpose? We're not here just serving Gordon Moore. We're here serving this great vision that God's given us. Yes, it's come through me. I'm the custodian of the vision, but it's no longer my vision. It's our vision. We believe in the vision. You know what I mean? And that's where a church breaks down the small church mindset, and churches grow through 200 when that begins to happen. Number three, we've already discussed this. The pastor shifts from minister to leader. And the more leadership I do, the less ministry I do. Here's another point. The growth potential increases in a church or a youth group or a women's ministry or department when the prime leader does more leadership. That's interesting. The growth potential increases when the prime leader does more leadership than ministry. So the more ministry you do, you're restricting the growth potential of your group, church, or ministry. Fruitfulness supersedes faithfulness. To get your church group to grow, you and I must select leaders on the basis of fruitfulness, not faithfulness. Okay? So when you get this, people go, why is he preaching? He's only been in here 5 minutes. I've been here 10 years. No one's ever asked me to preach. Well, that's because he's gifted at it and you're not. So we're not involving people based on faithfulness. We're involving people on the basis of fruitfulness. And fruitfulness is related to giftedness. Now, one of the 8 qualifications of healthy churches in national church development is gift-orientated ministry, which the charismatic movement was all about. So we identify people's gifts and we match the task or role in the church to their gift. Right? One of the clearest departments that you see that in is music. Now I can talk about it because I'm a musician. How come she's singing? I'm better than her. I've been around longer. I've been faithful. I've been here every year. And now you're just moving me aside and bringing this new person into my ministry. I thought, man, how are we going to deal with this? Like, what's the secret? And then I had a light bulb experience. Auditions. So what we do is we have the music director here. And we employ, because in our church, and probably in your city, even an unchurched person's good, because they'll probably tell the truth. I get in 2 qualified singing teachers. I've got them in my church, I've got about 3 or 4. My daughter's one of them, my younger daughter. She's got a double degree in drama music and has performed, and so she's qualified. And another lady who's a singing teacher, she sits there, she sits the MD, microphone, backing tape, sing. Perform. Taped. Come and sit down here. Let's play it back. And the 2 music teachers critique that person's voice. Right. I was amazed when I first did it. Half our band was tone deaf. They were flat. Half of them. I had to get rid of half our singers. I was surprised. But you see, in a smaller hall, we only had a small sound system and there was 1 mic and they were sharing. Then we built the new building and they all got a mic themselves. Oh, it didn't sound good. Now, I'm in tune with this because I'm a musician. You know what I mean? This is what I did. I was a music director for us. So I got an ear for it. Right? So then, all of a sudden, it goes like this. These singing teachers will give our singers a qualified summation of their voice and where they need to improve it. And people have to go away and either decide, music's not for me, well, not in this church anyway, because they didn't recognize my ministry, or they take singing lessons and they upgrade their skills, they come back at any time and they can re-audition. One girl who had such a passion for singing in our church, we found when she auditioned, we made everyone go through the process, everyone, even the MD. Everyone went through and auditioned and got evaluated. This one girl had one problem. Her top notes, her voice, when she went for top notes, she would fade and go flat. but it was only the top end. Her middle bottom range were perfect. She could have sat there and went, well, I've been faithful. I deserve to be on. Do you know what she said? What do I need to do? And the two qualified song leaders in unison said, you need to be personally coached to strengthen the muscles in your voice to the top end. Probably 6 months or more, it'll improve. But until then, you don't go on. Okay? She went away, talked it over with her husband. They put a couple of grand together and she went and got professionally trained. And what a delight it was to see her come out on the stage and performing and singing. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
You see, but that's a change in paradigm. Because when I started, I just wanted anyone to sing. I was glad to have singers. Right? But leadership moves the church from faithfulness to fruitfulness. Who is the best preacher? Who is the best song leader? Who is now at different stages? That varies. But it's a journey into that. You see that. And I think if we keep promoting people on the basis of faithfulness, we won't necessarily have fruitfulness happening in our church. And I believe you can measure fruitfulness by the fruit of their giftedness. We know that. Everyone moves from generalist to specialist. You know, in the church, when we get it started, everyone's doing everything. Helping on the door, handing out the books, singing. You know, one day I got sick of not having drums. I got up and learnt the drums. I learnt it in a day, like a couple of days. I went to the music practice on Wednesday, and I had a guy on the synth, and he was, you know, one of those, you know, you get techos. I won't say much more. Great guy. Pastor, I've solved it. Listen to this. And what he did was he organized, what would you call them, loops for singing in the spirit. I'm a rock and roller. You know, I like live. You've got to have it live, man. And I sat there thinking, that's not happening in our church. So I literally got the drum kit set up at home and got on the phone to my mate in Sydney and said, give me a drum lesson, mate. How do you do it? And he started to show me, and I thought, right, I've got it. And then that Sunday, I welcomed people at the door. I ran and got her behind the drums while my daughter song led. And then I got up and did the notices. And then I got back and did a worship song. And then I got up. See, I'm a generalist, right? But one day I had to go, this 16-year-old has the potential to be a really good drummer. So I raised some money through the church and we got him to go and get drum lessons. And he ended up one of our best drummers. Fantastic, right? And they didn't want me anymore. But, you know, we've got to all make a move, don't we? But sometimes we just want to hold on to all these things, but actually by releasing them, other people find their fulfillment.
Yeah.
See? And that's what it means, moving from a generalist to a specialist. We need to shift the church from encouragement to excellence. I'm guilty of this as anybody. Do you know Nick needs encouragement? He's been down lately. I reckon if we get him involved in the youth department, and maybe he could even be the youth leader, it'll really encourage him. What do you think, team? Yeah, well, let's encourage him. It stuffs up the youth department, but at least Nick feels good. You know what I'm trying to say? We're joking here. But so, see, that's the worst thing you can do in a church environment is promote people because you want to encourage them. If they need encouragement, get them counselling. But we think ministry will encourage people, but it actually has the reverse effect. What we need to do is say to Nick, Nick, you need help if you're discouraged. Let's help you on a one-on-one. Let's get some counseling. Let's give him help. But we don't promote him to encourage him. Now, a good friend of mine had a church of around 80, 90 people. He was just in pioneering stage, and he had a woman join the church who had some problems. And he thought it'd be a really great idea to involve her. He lost probably half a dozen families from his church like that. Because she got amongst the kids on the Sunday while everyone's worshipping the Lord, she's pounding on them, you know, because she had emotional kind of, you know, and you want to really reveal that, just go into the kids ministry, you know, and he lost a few good families out of the church because, and he remember him saying to me, he said, Gordon, I made the biggest mistake in my life. I got her involved to encourage her rather than she was the best person for that job. Now, the best person doesn't mean the best person in the world. It's the best person you've got available at that time. And then as your church progresses, maybe you've got to go to that person and say, look, I feel your time is finished. And we've got this young guy here, Anthony. Man, he looks awesome. He's got a vision for the youth. Nick, I want you to move into deaconing or shepherding or something. And I want Andrew now to take this over, a young guy. And we're creating an environment all the time. Who's the best person to do that job? Why? Because the goal is not whether Nick feels good or I feel good, right? The goal is growing the church, making the church at the best it can be for us. So that's a major shift. But I find small church mentality is, oh, I liked it when we could all have a go. Yeah. Or board members, when is it my turn to do communion? Listen, you don't do turns in the kingdom. It's your time or it's not your time. It's a whole different thing. So if you say, oh, we want a turn, I want to go on the roster. I say, no. You don't have a turn on the roster. It's not for turns. It's whether the time is on Anthony or the time is on Nick. So if the time's on Nick to be youth pastor and he's not ready yet, then we appoint Nick and we say to Anthony, Anthony, we want you to work with Nick and learn everything you can. Then when he rises up, I need to talk to Nick and say, hey, Nick, it's time for you to move on and do something else. I think Anthony's ready. What do you think? And if he's got half a brain, he will go, I reckon Anthony's ready. It's his time, and it's time for me to move on. And I find in the church, actually, most people get that. They really get it. But it's creating a culture where that's cool, that we're all in stages. And you know, the top team in any church, they literally do everything. You know, my son-in-law, he's done deaconing, guitar playing, music director, youth pastor, general runabout, you know, fixing typewriters, computers, to just everything. Why? Because it's not important. It's just this is a belief I have. What I do in church is actually not as important as who I am in church. So, and poor David, isn't David awesome? He's the king, man. He's the guru. He's everything. What does he say? I'd rather be a doorkeeper. I just want to be in the house of God, man. You know, I'll do this because this is my time. It's what God called me to do. But let me just be a doorkeeper in the house of God. I thought that was, I love that. And I think to myself as a senior minister, because I have to confront it. Because, you know, I'm 55. And I've got to be aware that one day someone better ought to be doing this. And my time has shifted, and you know, I go, well, I started this thing. I was in the hard yards. I did the hard yards, mate. You didn't do the hard yards. Move aside. No, I'm going to have to come to a point where I'm going to say, I feel my time, there's a shift here, and there's a process, and I understand that, but I'm going to have to shift, aren't I? And make a shift, and say to a young guy like Andrew, Andrew, it's your time to take the youth group, mate. We believe in you. Rather than, you know, well, we don't want to offend Nick, and you know, he'll get offended, and he just needs encouragement. He'll probably leave. He'll get discouraged too. So there's management of that. Let me just throw this in, also just something I've learned. The bigger the move, the longer you take, and the more the communication. Right? So in other words, you know what I'm saying? The bigger the shift or the move you need to make in the church, the longer time you take to do it, and the greater the communication, talking to everyone. I'd be talking to Anthony. You married Anthony? So I'd be talking to your wife. Right? I want a meeting with you and her. You don't just go, you're in, you're out. No, I want to talk to your wife. I want to find out if she's happy. I want my wife to talk to her without you there. What's he like at home? Does he? Because I'm going to put you up as a youth leader. People are going to follow you. So I want to know what your wife thinks about you, right? I'm going to find all that out. I'm going to ask the other youth leaders, what do you think of Anthony? You know, what do you think? You know? Okay, and what does Nick think? Is he ready? And when do you think he'll be ready? And it could be, hey, he's not ready yet, let's do it early next year. You know what I'm saying? So if that's a big shift, then you need to take more time in it, and you need a lot more of that communication happening so that it happens smoothly. 10 more minutes, we've got to get through this. Bigger levels, bigger devils. You don't want to hear me on that. Nah, we'll do it. Bigger levels, bigger devils. This is the deal I found. When you take a step forward in anything, there will be a spiritual contention. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. Don't believe me? Try buy a building. I couldn't believe it. I just go to buy this building. It's like, you know, all of a sudden Beelzebub turns up. It's like, you got problems on the left and the right. You got people in your church. You got this thing, but it was God. God wants it, right? Last time we did a building extension, the council made us do a frog study for $2,000. There's no frogs in the creek, I'm telling you right now. Oh, yes, there is. There's a green, battered, spotted, whatever frog. $2,000. We've got Bunnings opposite us and several big electrical stores. It's sort of like 10,000 cars a day or whatever. I can't remember the figure. It was like that. Once a week, 1,000 cars. Right? So here's our church and here's Bunnings and all these other shops, right? We had to do a traffic assessment by an expert to prove that we weren't unduly affecting Bunnings by our traffic. $2,000 later, you know what I'm trying to say? So now I can get all up and say, oh, you know, that's the council, there's demons in there and all that. It's got nothing to do with that. It's the moment you take a step forward, you decide to grow your church, you decide to buy a building, you decide to change something and move ahead. The devil wants you and me to be contained. Because when we're contained, we're not a problem to him. You start growing the church, you start building a youth ministry, you start expanding what you're doing and influencing your city, your town, the devil, he ain't happy about it. And one of the things I've found is we have to have this incredible prayer ministry behind us. And then if you use the inside-out principle, it makes it a lot more easy. So you're not standing alone. And that is when you do the inside-out, first of all, you're sure that you're sure. You know God's spoken to you, this is what I'm going to do. You then get your wife on board, or your partner. You're in this together. Then you talk to your key players, your pastors, your board. They're all on board. Then you go to your leaders, and they're on board. Haven't gone public yet. Let them talk about it. Get communicating. Get them excited. They're all on board. They're all praying. Then you go to the members. Then on a Sunday, you get up in the pulpit and say, have a guess what we're doing, church. Now, 70% of them are all on board already. They're all in there with you, praying, believing. Amen? Right? You get up in the pulpit, you say, we are going to buy some land and build a building. They're, hey! Then you tell them how much it's going to cost after that. But you see what I'm trying to say? Well, I find what happens often in the church, we take this warfare thing, that's a strategy. I call it the inside-out strategy. What we do is we work from the outside in. We get a vision, we're going to buy land. We stand in the church and go, hey, have a guess what, church? I had a vision last night. We're going to buy land. And goes quiet. You know. Then you go, oh, I better convince people. So then you try to bring people on board from the outside in. It's not a good strategy. You need to always position yourself in a place of strength. Because the moment you begin to move forward, the devil will be there to contend it. And so you need armor bearers. You need people that are praying and fighting with you so that when you move ahead, even though there will be opposition, you overcome it. Amen? That's an incredible principle. So what I've been talking about, let's sum up now. Viability. What is viability? I'm healthy enough, resourced enough, and big enough to fulfill the God-given purpose for my church. For someone here, that could be 200, another person 500, another person 2,000. Numbers are irrelevant. It's all about health and viability. So the starting point is your vision, not how much money. Whatever. Be very clear on your vision, what God has put in your heart, and then build your church to be viable enough to make that happen. When you have grown your church to a point where your vision starts to be able to be worked out, resourced, happening, then you are viable enough. Interesting, isn't it? So I think that is a dynamic thing. When I went to Australia, my vision that God showed me was I thought if I could have 500 in the mother church and about three or four other plants working together, that would be really great. But I remember sitting in church when we got there, and I felt the Lord say to me one day, your vision's too small. Just came like that out of the blue. So then it's like, oh, okay. So then I had to redress my vision, redraw it bigger and go for more. And then God, you know, and then we did this current building. I remember board meetings and leadership meetings, the wish list, and then narrow it down, you know, and what are we going to do, you know, and we're going to stage it, and we're going to do this, and it'll take 3 years. And I thought, we ain't got time for 3 years. We're growing by 400 plus a year. I've got to have more seats. I've got to have more Sunday school. We've got to do it now. What are we going to do? Middle of the night, one night, whack, sitting up in the middle of the night, God spoke to me, go to double. That's all he said to me. And I knew what he was saying, man. And I was as scared as anything, man. So I called an emergency meeting of the board. And I said, God's spoken to me. And I said, wow, what did he say? I said, you got to get ready for this. He said, go to double. We are doubling this building. We are doubling the auditorium. I said, write it down in the minutes. We're doubling the auditorium. We're doubling them. We're doubling this. We're doubling. There is one word that's banned now. Stages. This is the stage. Double is the stage. I remember one of my board members, he's been with me for a long time, he said, Gordon, I know how on earth this is going to happen, buddy, but if you said God spoke, I'm in. Let's make it happen. Let's make it happen. So we started to go down a journey of 2 years of making this happen, but I'll tell you what, we're in it. Now we're going again, we've got to double it again, we've got to go again, you know what I'm trying to say? So what I'm saying is, viability is not how much people you have. It's, are you healthy enough to do what God's asked you to do? And I, you know, honestly, numbers don't impress me. Because I've been around the church world long enough to know you can be in a large church and be unhappy. And you can be in a smaller church and be serving God, and boy, it's awesome. Right? So it's not about that. It's about the health of the congregation. And what you and I need to become as key pastors and leaders is great health builders, getting Christians healthy and building. So there it is, you know, the natural church development. I haven't got time to go into that today because I've only got 3 minutes left. There are the eight things. You can get those later. If you just go online, go on to Natural Church Development, Christian Swartz, awesome, you can do that. So what is viability? What does it mean to be resourced enough? You need people, you need money, you need facilities, you need equipment, you need tools to get the job done. That's what it means. And as long as you and I don't have those tools or people or resources to fulfill the God-given vision, then we need some more work to do. We need to grow a bit, we need to get more healthy, whatever. We need more money, we need whatever to do what God's asked us to do. Big enough, here's my thoughts. I actually think that once a church, and this is my personal opinion, once a church breaks through that 200 barrier, viability becomes really in your hand. It's never a finished work, it's not like idealistic, but by the time a church breaks through 200, there's usually other pastors and leaders that are on staff helping. Money's usually flowing a bit more. A church at that size can talk about either leasing a permanent building to give them 7 day a week presence in a community, or buy a building, you know what I'm trying to say. But if you try that with 75 people, it really becomes kind of like a struggle for the church. As a matter of fact, we actually encourage churches not to get into buildings too quickly, but to build the life of the church and the energy of the church. And if the church is healthy, all this will take care of itself. Viable means more than one leader. Leadership team is established. Evangelism is happening naturally. Departments function by themselves in their own right. So you as the senior leader are not having to bail all the time and find money and do this and do. They tend to operate under your leadership in their own right. That is a real sign of viability. Facility issues are solved. That doesn't mean completed, but you're in a place where you can function as a church. One of the things that's happening in Australia quite a lot because of the costs is churches are not worrying about buying a big building like this at all first up. They lease a ministry centre. So that means an office in the main town, maybe just a little office with maybe a seminar room that can seat, you know, 30 people, so you can do training, prayer, and you hire a hall on the Sunday or whatever for your meetings. You see what I'm saying? So that's a thing that's happening in Australia right now, because it's really important, you know, that we find things that work, and that'll differ according to your location and your church. Structures are in place to sustain church life. So it's not just a wobbly jelly. There are structures in place that are actually helping sustain this life. Okay? And you've got that clearly there. So I'm finished. And there's 1 minute, and there might be time for one more question, because it's 1 minute too. Is there one final question? Maybe someone that hasn't asked a question before that is on your heart you'd like to ask. Sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Could we hear your five values?
My five values? Yes, my five values. The vision or the purpose is to build the church. The five values are church for the unchurched. This is not in order. Worship of God, and by that we mean prayer, worship, devotional life, right? The worship, I live for God. As a matter of fact, I think that's number one on our official documentation. Relevant, oh, that might be the first one, because we've changed the language, sorry about that. Excellence in all ministry and leadership. Right? We're painting our building just about every week. Something's happening, repairing, no holes in the wall, no scratches on doors, no broken windows, nothing, everything, bang, bang. And now I've hired a guy, he works 4 days a week, and one of his jobs every Monday is to go through and organise the fixing of everything. Just sloppy door knobs, everything. Lights. I can't believe how many light bulbs go out in the building. Can you, Nick? Anyway, but it happens. Okay, so excellence. What else have we got? The success. Oh, I know. The success of the believer. I've been accused of being a prosperity teacher. Really? That's what I am. Beloved, I pray above all things you may prosper and be in health. Everybody. Sorry, guilty. But if they mean, you know, I'm a fanatic or whatever. No, but I happen to, that's a value. I want every marriage in our church to succeed. I want every kid in our church not just to grow up and have a job. I want them to have a career. And that's really happening in our church. It's so exciting. In the recent, in the 2001 NCLS, our church comes up as one of the highest educated churches in the country. I just love that. Because you've got to understand, that doesn't mean they all come from privileged homes. You understand. These come from a lot of working class homes and problems, and, you know, and even white collar, they've bailed out of school and not completed their education. Come into our church, we go, hey, you're going to succeed in life, right? You are going to succeed. This is what happens in this church. You're not here to fail. You're not a loser anymore. You're going to be a winner. And that might be in sport. So we've got all these kids getting represented. We've got a girl in our church. She's in the B team for Australia women's netball. She's in the squad, you know. 17. Tall like this, beautiful girl. So we're saying, go for it. We're praying for you, right? It could be business, whatever. Okay? So that's a big one. And the last one is, oh yeah, we're a family church. With a focus on youth and children. So we're not a youth church, we're a family church. We believe in the family. That's just me. You know, my wife and I, we believe in the family, okay? So we're a family church with a focus on youth and children. So we build those five values around building the church. Now, it's taken me years to get there. People say, what about prayer? No, prayer's not a value. Prayer is not a goal. Prayer is what we are. That's, we talk to God. You know what I mean? A value is more to do with culture. And then we've gone further to have defined the culture. And we've got a whole thing that we talk about that, but we don't promote that necessarily. And there's stuff like, you know, we're free, we're informal, we're fun. Humour's allowed in our church. You know, whatever. We're educated, so that's all culture. Hey, it's been a delight sharing with you today. There's been a lot of stuff, and I hope I haven't overwhelmed you. But I hope even if there's one or two things you can take home and go, man, I could do this. I hope out of all of this you've got hope. So that you can say, hey, maybe some pastors here today, you know, you feel, man, our church has sort of got stuck a bit. I hope today, I really hope, this is my passion, you had a light bulb go on in your head to say, hey, wait a minute, I don't have to stay here. You know, I can do something. I can move my church or maybe my youth group, women's group. I can move this thing. I can get momentum and get it moving. That's my prayer, that you will be viable and you will fulfill everything that God's put in your heart to achieve. Hey, the Lord bless you.